therefore have built it. And I didn't want to be part of dismantling it. So you can't call it the world's greatest music station. You cannot make such a claim. I am the only one of the first 19 managing directors who did not walk out a millionaire.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which we talk to those who made a difference. Stuart Francis.
I was born in Purley in Surrey. I had what would be described as someone born after the war, 1951, as an idyllic childhood. But I managed to squeak into Wallingham County School, where I did absolutely no work at all. I was one of those terrible students who did what they thought was important. And the only things that I thought were important were English art, history, geography, and sport. And it got round to the sixth form, and I was a bit of a rebel. And I ended up realising that I was spending half my time sitting in the room behind the art room with a Mr. George, who was the only teacher who sort of befriended me and I think could see something perhaps creative in me, and going to the odd English lesson and realising that my timetable didn't look like anybody else's timetable because there's very little on it. And I got halfway through the sixth form, about to do A-levels, and I really don't know the motivation behind this, but I left school and I went home, and I didn't go back. And at the same time that that was going on, I was sitting listening to Wonderful Big L.
19 and a half minutes past the hour of 1 o'clock on the Tony Blackburn Show, and if you've got your chisels and hacksaws ready now, whatever you might write with, pencils and paper, if you're just an ordinary person,
magic coming out of the radio. That was my life-changing moment, listening to Radio London, because I decided that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to sit on a ship and play records.
Wonderful Radio London.
So I left school, decided to be a DJ, and bought some equipment, some SP25s, went out onto the road with some chums, and I remember driving back to school 6 months after leaving in a Lotus Elan. I drove past the school. I didn't actually drive into the school and park up and show this Lotus Elan. Mind you, when I didn't get a few gigs and I couldn't afford to pay the hire purchase, it got changed in for a mini Clubman, one of those cars with a wooden back on it, which I could just about get the decks and the speakers in. And so I went on the South London DJ circuit. And then there was a bit of business acumen. I realised that a lot of pubs were changing their back rooms into discos. Bit of UV lighting, painting the walls black, stage and a disco unit. And a friend of mine had a DIY shop, and we started turning out sets of disco equipment. And we used to go into pubs and basically kit them out and do one day a week, and it turned into a little business. But behind all this was that desire that I wanted to be on the radio. So just like everybody else, I could also paper my wall with rejection slips from the BBC, who I started to apply to about the age of 17. Eventually, I sent them a tape and I was asked to go up to Broadcasting House. And I went into this studio with Stuart Grundy. And I sat down in the studio with this wonderful equipment, gates, turntables and great big levers that you pull and that sort of thing. And sitting in the studio next door was J.Y. Jimmy Young was sitting there. And this was extraordinary. I came out of the audition and I got a letter to say, you've passed the audition. Because what some people don't realise is that when you went for audition at the BBC, you either failed it or you passed it. If you passed it, it didn't mean to say they gave you Tony Blackburn's breakfast show the next day, but you were on a list and you would be called in occasionally to then audition for other programmes. I was given a couple of gigs on Radio 1 Club where they had a guest DJ who might interview someone or do that. But it became pretty clear that I wasn't going to break into the high echelons of Blackburn and David Hamilton and JY and all of those. And I heard about the coming of legalised commercial radio, and I set my sights on that. And I joined Roger Squire. Roger was a very smart guy because he had the disco business and he had that little house in St John's Wood, which is a great premier location. And he built the studio upstairs. But it was the place to go to because there wasn't anywhere else. There weren't any radio stations. You couldn't go into the BBC. You couldn't do things on laptops. And that gave me a playroom. I could play all day making radio programmes. And not only that, I could observe other people coming in, how they made their audition tapes, what they did, and I would produce or engineer their audition tapes. Johnny Walker used to come in once a week and record a chart show for the States. This would have been 72, something like that. I have the honour of saying that I produced Dale Winton's radio audition tape. Dale, I think, was a year younger than me. He was fresh-faced, enthusiastic, and had a great voice. And that is what I remember. And he was very good.
And it's a big hug and a kiss from me, Dale. Goodbye.
One of the tapes that I made got me a proper job on the radio. And I applied to both Capital and LBC. And I was auditioned by both. In Capital's case, I met Michael Bucht. But it was actually Dave Cash who turned up when I did my studio interview. And they said to me afterwards, well, that's quite interesting. We haven't got a position now, but in the new year, we might have something through the night. So I thought, well, that's positive. In the meantime, LBC asked to see me. Accent on the asked to see me. I never sat in a studio for LBC. Nobody in that first presentation team sat in a studio and auditioned. This was London's newspaper of the air. That's what they called it, which of course was its greatest mistake. And they recruited these extraordinarily talented people from the world of journalism, but nobody knew how to make a radio station work. Michael Cudlip was the editor from the great Cudlip news family. Geoffrey Wonsell was the head of programming. Ron Onions, I think, was the head of news. Keith Belcher was also there, who was a giant of a man. I mean, physically, but also just in the way that he conducted things. And he had a vision about news on the radio that was different to the BBC.
It was very, very exciting and very tiring, too, because an awful lot of us were putting in literally 24-hour shifts on the station in those days.
I went along and had this interview, and they said, you'll do. We want you to do the afternoon show. And I later learned there were only two people hired by LBC who had any radio experience at all. One was Steve Merrick, and one was me. So they asked me to do the afternoon show, and they asked Steve to do Nightline. And we did some dry runs. And they didn't like what Steve did on Nightline. They thought it was too commercial radio. You can imagine how Steve would do a phone-in with his great enthusiasm and everything else. So their answer was to swap me onto Nightline, put Steve onto the afternoon show, where he could be controlled by Gillian Strickland from the great Strickland News family and Belle Mooney, who was Jonathan Dimbleby's wife.
The time on London Broadcasting is 2:10. Welcome to At Home. My name is Belle Mooney. With me in the studio is Steve Merrick. And
hello.
He is indeed 5 days a week sitting there loyally. While
Don't say it like that.
Gillian Strickland and I swap over and go off shopping, but Steve's here 5 days a week.
The story continues with me starting on Nightline. And I remember on the first day of broadcasting in October 73... that I got up somewhat unwisely at 6 o'clock in the morning to hear the first broadcast of LBC, and I listened throughout the day, and I knew I was going to be on the air until 6 o'clock the following morning, because Nightline ran for 8 hours. started at 10 and went through till 6. And I listened to this radio station, and I knew when I went on the air that I had 2 hours that I had sewn up with interviews and everything, and then I was going to be by myself for 6 hours. And it sounds odd today, but I was asking myself the question, what happens if nobody rings? Nobody knew whether anyone was listening to LBC. There hadn't been a phone call all day. No one had done an open line phone-in on UK radio. I sat there that evening, reading the Evening Standard, reading everything that I possibly could, thinking that there was somehow I could talk my way out of this if nobody rang. Amongst my first guests were Elkin Allen, who was the TV and radio correspondent for The Times, and Alan Wicker, which was rather good. And we got through to midnight, and after the midnight news, I opened the lines, and every line on the switchboard lit up, and I couldn't believe it.
But I understand we do have some calls in the Nightline studio at the moment, so if I could say hello to our next caller. Hello.
Hi.
Hello there.
First night, a lady comes on the air who was blind and made tea towels or something, and said that she was this great fan of Danny LaRue and he was her idol. 5 minutes later, I get a signal from the control room, because everything was controlled by engineers and lots of people there and producers and things. Signal came through, got Danny LaRue on the line, finished his show at the Palladium or whatever it was. And he came on, he said how moved he was by this, and he wanted to arrange for this lady to, and it was hold on the line, you know, and we'll arrange for you to get, Danny wants to give you tickets to the London Palladium. 4 o'clock in the morning, I get another call, which says Andre Previn's on the line. Andre Previn comes on the air and says, I'm an insomniac. What you are doing is the best thing that's happened to my life in years. I have something live that I can listen to conversation, London talking to each other. This just went on and on. And we built a really substantial late night audience. We're talking 500,000, middle of the night in London. I think it was the only time that the LBC audience beat Capital Radio's audience.
You're with Stuart Francis. This is Nightline. And if you'd like to call us after the break, we'd be happy to hear from you on the subject. The Nightline studio of LBC, London Broadcasting, 417 metres in the medium wave band, 97.3 VHF. And I must apologise if I'm saying that rather a lot tonight, but we are trying to make sure that everybody knows exactly where we are on the dial.
After 2 months, I don't really know what happened, but Steve left the afternoon show. Steve went to do something else. And they asked me to go back and do the afternoon show, which I did. And we would do anything. We were probably the first radio station to talk about serious matters, like rape crisis centres, and mention the word rape and menopause and things that hadn't been talked about on the radio. At the same time, I recall a feature where over 1 week, we taught you how to build a rabbit hutch. And this man came in telling you how to build a rabbit hutch on the radio. You put the screw in here and you put that and you measure 1 inch from there. It's just surreal, some of the things we did. I don't think that I realised at the time just how important LBC going on the air in October 1973 was. It was the first commercial radio station. It had to go on the air a week earlier than Capital. And it was national news. The day before we went on the air, the Daily Express ran a page article with a photo of me with the rather odd title, An Uncle for London. Not quite sure where that came from. And within 2 weeks of doing Nightline, the Daily Mirror sent photographers round, and I was a two-page centre spread in the Daily Mirror. This really was important stuff.
It is well known that the Labour Party have opposed the introduction of commercial broadcasting, but that in no way prevents me from offering my best wishes to the Independent Broadcasting News Service.
There are a lot of people who wanted us to fail, mainly large newspaper groups who saw it as a threat. But I think we very quickly won the hearts and minds of Londoners. But people like George Gale, the incredibly gruff George Gale, right-wing politics, former editor of the Daily Express, doing a two-hour morning broadcast, live phone calls. And that was unknown at the time.
I will be, in the normal fashion, responding to your questions and invitations for my own opinions.
So I did that, and I had the great opportunity to hone my interview skills. And I interviewed both prime ministers of that era, Heath and Wilson.
When did you first start writing the book?
Oh, I started thinking it out at the beginning of the year, when the referendum campaign came.
I commented on the boat race. I didn't know anything about, well, I knew it was Oxford and Cambridge, but what do I know about rowing? So I sat myself next to the Daily Telegraph's rowing correspondent, who was about 85 and had done just about every boat race there'd been. And I didn't realise these boats went so fast. And we were in the Timekeeper's launch, which is immediately behind the two university crews. And the flag went down, off went these two boats at this huge speed. The launch lurched forward. I was holding the radio mic, sitting in the back seat, and dropped the radio mic in the River Thames. And that was the end of LBC's boat race coverage, which was being networked into the IRN news at various points. That's the sort of thing that LBC did.
A gunman with a white handkerchief has literally just come out. Really, it is so dark up that end now. We obviously are going to have to wait for the firm confirmation of the police.
The use of the motor rollers, which are like a handheld walkie-talkie device virtually, linking to an aerial on top of the Hilton, meant that we could get anywhere quickly and do anything on the air, which the BBC couldn't. They were still getting their outside broadcast crews together and getting them from wherever the parking lot was and rigging them up and all the rest of it. Which is why, when I was on Nightline, we got the Princess Anne shooting in the Mall first. All the taxi drivers listened to LBC. And it was an LBC taxi driver that rang through to the producer in my studio, said, "There's been a shooting on the Mall, and I'm sure it's Princess Anne in the car." Sorry, a shooting attempt on Princess Anne. We had a guy from Fleet Street to there, probably in 5 minutes, with a motor roller and standing there broadcasting, describing the scene. The BBC arrived about 2-3 hours later. We were able to do those things. I was on air when Nixon resigned. And I still can't forget it today, that Nixon resigned our time midnight because he was going to be impeached. And I still remember today looking at that clock as it ticks up, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And I'm saying, we are going to cross to the White House to hear from the President of the United States. Half a second pause and good evening.
Good evening. This is the 37th time I have spoken to you from this office, where so many decisions have been made that shaped the history of this nation.
And Richard Nixon was there, and that was the most powerful man in the world had to go, which became the subject of David Frost's book, I Gave Them a Sword, and the television documentaries that I later interviewed David Frost about.
Well, my special guest today is someone who, above all others, always succeeds in bringing something a little special to our TV screens. And his book, I Gave Them a Sword, Frost on Nixon, provides us with not only a fascinating insight into the former US president, but also, I suspect, an insight into the personality of the author. My guest today, David Frost.
Top of the morning, Stuart.
Welcome. You made it at last.
Yes, yes. I was in Paris. I got up at 5:30 this morning to shoot
it. It's those magical and yet simple things that radio can do. And I think, for all its faults and mistakes, LBC did give BBC News a kick. The LBC studios were just off Fleet Street, and most of the building that we occupied, the broadcasters, was actually in the basement. But the programmers had a first floor office with windows. And the team comprised of what could be regarded as quite a highly volatile group, very talented. The morning show was Paul Callan and Janet Street Porter. Lunchtime was Jon Snow, the late Carol Barnes. David Jessel did breakfast. Because almost everything was of a double-headed nature, and because you weren't sitting there doing what you were told, that the presenters had also become largely the producers, then it was a particularly argumentative attitude, which was indeed healthy. But if you have to sit there for 2 hours every morning listening to an argument between Paul Callan and Janet Street Porter, which results in a typewriter being thrown out of the window, that those sort of things happen. But there was a great sense that we were pioneers, that we were doing something different. But what we did is that we actually said what was on the tin. News comes first. We will get it on the air first. And we did. We so frequently beat the BBC that they had to change. And don't let's forget that 2 years later, when I left, and the reason that I left LBC was because they introduced a rolling news format that we're all very familiar with now. Before it was programmes and news, became rolling news. I was offered the job in the helicopter to be the eye in the sky over London. And I didn't want to do that. I was a programming man. If I'd stayed and done it, I probably would have been ever so famous, like Bob Holness. So having made the decision to leave LBC, I had to look around for another job. And Pennine Radio were advertising for presenters. So I went for an audition for Pennine Radio, which was held in the Capital Radio studios. Austin Mitchell was going to be the program controller, and Philip Whitehead, the managing director, were both there. I was told I would do a program for half an hour. I played two records, and Austin Mitchell said, "You're hired." So I said, "Thank you very much." Went up to Yorkshire, found a house. Week before we went on the air, Austin Mitchell's bosses at Yorkshire Television said, "You can't do these two jobs." And so they asked Steve Merrick, who they had hired, to be the programme controller at Pennine Radio. So again, I had moved and followed Steve. I'd been hired as head of music, and Steve was involved in the hiring of a very, very talented team of people, who included Peter Levy, who now hosts Look North, Julius K. Scragg at Tea Time, Roger Kirk. It was a great team. I can't let
Maggie go. Ah, that's the way it goes on a Tuesday morning. The 16th of September, 1975. That's the Honey Bus there, and their song called I Can't Let Maggie Go.
We put the station on the air, and the usual thing happened that always happened to commercial radio stations. It won a decent audience and didn't get any revenue, and politics took over, and it all became a nightmare. Steve went through absolutely no fault of his own, but face didn't fit with the latest management that had walked in, etc. They asked me to be programmed something, basically to run it, while one of the directors acted as program director. The station did pretty well. I've got really fond memories, not least because that's the station where I was nominated in the Local Radio Awards for Best Presenter, along with Michael Aspel and Kenny Everett, and went down to the Grosvenor House. And the following year I won it for the Best Music Programme for Greensleeves, 1,000 Years of History of English Music. We also launched what I think is the first radio on-air auction. I believe we did it before Capital's Help a London Child, and ours was called HACAC, Help a Child at Christmas. Head of music at Pennine in 1975 was a wonderful job to have, because obviously a computer didn't tell you what you had to play. You had playlist meetings, and my view was that we brought all the jocks together and we decided together what was going to be on the playlist. it was a collective decision. I think that there are some downsides. The downsides is that for the head of music, it's a bit of a nightmare trying to corral all these thoughts and then put them through a filter, and something coherent has to come out. But the fact that you've taken the trouble to actually do that means that those people on air have ownership and they really care about what they're playing. There was always the free choice bit, you know, one free choice in half an hour and another free choice in another half hour. But we'd discuss the parameters you could make your free choice. And then we would argue about it afterwards. There were great arguments going on in the programme office. But that is so creative. These people cared about the music and they wanted to make it work. You know whether that can segue into that. You know what you need to do there. You know exactly how to position the break. Let's talk about it. Let's get it right. It's the sound that matters. In terms of the music, 75 to 80, it was an interesting period. It had some very good music, but it was full of weird sort of novelty stuff. I mean, on a popular music station, would you play the Birdie song today? I mean, we probably played it to death, you know, and you know, Wombling Merry Christmas and all that stuff. But somehow these guys had the ability, someone like Julius K. Scragg, had the ability to play that sort of 12-inch disco sound in a program that would also include, I don't know, Matt Munro or the Birdies. I can't even think how you did that, but it sounded right.
Yes, there we are. That's Ken Dodd, and Think of Me Wherever You Are. Well, it's time for me to welcome my guest of the morning.
I took risks. It was easier to take risks in those days. There weren't four or five commercial radio signals coming into the same town. So it might all sound, you know, reasonably clever, but what were we up against? We were up against Radio 1, Radio 2. There were three stations in most markets. That was it. And we had local on our side and FM. I took one of the biggest risks I've taken as a program controller. And I took our commercial producer and put him on The Breakfast Show. And his name was Mike Hurley. And Mike Hurley is one of the most talented people, the late Mike Hurley, one of the most talented commercial producers and one of the most talented broadcasters. Clever, witty, pushing the envelope all the time. I think that was one of my best decisions. So there was quite a lot of innovative stuff going on there. It also coincided with the first tragedy that happened in my life. My first wife and I, our daughter was stillborn in Air Valley Hospital. We're talking now 1976. And things were dealt with in a very, very different way then. And I remember being in the delivery suite and being asked to leave by one of the doctors and told privately that they can't hear a heartbeat. And me saying, well, we better go and tell my wife, and what are you going to do about it, whatever. And the doctor saying, we'd prefer if you didn't tell your wife. I look back on that moment and realise that was the biggest lie I ever told anybody in my life. That I went back in that room and allowed my wife to deliver. I mean, what the doctor had meant was they didn't want to have to do a caesarean, that it would be easier to do it. It would never be done today. And I remember my wife giving birth, and I remember this bundle being taken away, and I can see it now, because I can see one leg coming out from beneath the blanket that was holding her. And that's the only time that I saw my child. Because again, in those days, stillborn babies were just put in an unmarked grave somewhere. My wife was put into a ward where women had their children. I don't have a great memory. but there are some things that are indelibly stamped on your memory. And I can remember walking down this corridor, which seemed like a mile long, to go and collect the death certificate for my child. And in some way, I think what happened on that day and the subsequent days provided a motivation for what I was going to do later in life. It was a moment I never forgot. It took me many years to get round to doing something that I felt might be helpful in the area of health. After that, we had a second son, 2 years later, who was born in Yorkshire. Eventually, the politics of Pennine was such that actually creative people just didn't want to be there any longer. And I decided it was time to make a move. So I left Pennine and I joined Hereward Radio before they went on the air in 1980. I think I was the second person after the chief engineer to be hired by Cecilia Garnett, who was the first woman MD in commercial radio.
We've, for the first time ever, given really, truly local businesses an opportunity to advertise their products.
And I think for the first time, I nearly had a blank canvas. There were one or two things that had been preordained when I arrived. The jingles had been commissioned, and the DJ from South Africa had been asked to fly over and join us. I found the rest of them, and I went as head of programmes, and Ralph Bernard went as head of news from Hallam. And we put together this mixed format daytime programming with speech and music, which I had become wedded to.
Good morning, you're listening to Hereward Radio, broadcasting on 225 metres in the medium wave, that's 1332 kilohertz and 95.7 VHF in stereo. In a moment, the news at 6, followed by Daybreak with myself, Dave Bowen, and Jonathan Kramer.
And again, the usual thing happened. We won a fantastic audience. We were always in the late 40s reach, and no revenue. So gradually the station went bust. And Ralph had made the decision to move, and he went to the radio station in Swindon. Cecilia left and went to Invicta in Kent. And I stayed and ended up as chair of AIRC, the Association of Independent Radio Contractors, the trade body for all commercial radio, and running Mid-Anglia Radio PLC. Before Cecilia had left, we had won the licence for Northampton. I don't know how we did that.
From today, your radio will never be the same again.
When I became managing director, Martin George took over as chair. He was chairman of Whitworth's from the Weetabix family. The station was broke. My first task was to go with our deputy chairman down to Barclays in London to negotiate a loan. My second task was to sell Northampton, which was another first. So could you actually win a station? Could you sell a station in those days? So we knew that Chiltern wanted to expand. And so I asked Colin Mason, the managing director of Chiltern Radio, to go out to lunch. And my board had said to me, if you can get rid of it for nothing, it will stem the losses. Colin asked me how much we wanted for it. And I just did the usual tactics of not saying anything. And he came up with a figure, and eventually we agreed £200,000 and we sold the station.
In the long term, Northants 96 will be a great success.
Wigbusters! Tony West.
Good morning and welcome to the very first programme on Northants 96.
We then concentrated on getting Hereward right, getting the revenue up, and the station was turned round within 3 years, which was in time for us to use our newfound wealth to invest in Cambridge when we won the license for Cambridge to become CNFM. And then a year or so later, we also won the license for King's Lynn, KLFM. We split frequencies, as everybody did. We launched the AM station, WGMS, which was the station I'd always wanted to launch because it was Big L. WGMS was the world's greatest music station. And I remember having an argument with the radio authority. So you can't call it the world's greatest music station. You cannot make such a claim. So I said, well, you're just reading it wrong. Why have you got a problem with the world's greatest music station? We're playing the world's greatest music. We're not claiming to be the world's greatest music station. And I remember these letters going to and fro. And eventually they got fed up and they said yes. And we played all exactly the same music that they would have played in those 2 or 3 years in the 60s, and that's all we played. We played all the same jingles. And we had jocks who lived in the era. And it sounded wonderful. I think we got about a 15% reach on AM. People often ask me about relationships with regulators and the high degree of regulation that radio was under. For example, when we launched Hereward, we were told 3 weeks before we went on the air that we couldn't broadcast beyond 9 o'clock in the evening because we had to prove we could get it right before we were allowed to then go to 10 o'clock and then to midnight and then to 1 o'clock. And this was to be done in stages. The fact we'd hired the DJs to actually present those programmes was irrelevant. We were mandated the minutes of news that we could broadcast. We had to attend the local radio advisory group meetings as programme controllers.
Sunday morning on the Costa del Sol, and among the holidaymakers, three Irish terrorists were planning a bloodbath.
The fundamental change in regulation happened when ITV broadcast the programme Death on a Rock, which was the shooting of IRA members by British soldiers. Margaret Thatcher had rung the chairman of the IBA and said, virtually, you will not broadcast this. And he said he would broadcast it. And from that moment on, Margaret Thatcher was determined to get the Independent Broadcasting Authority. Absolutely determined. And that is how deregulation started. From that, the IBA was split up into television, radio. We at AIRC were campaigning anyway to have our own regulatory arm. We always felt that until you had somebody concentrating on radio, it would never grow to its full potential. So when I became chair of AIRC, deregulation was very recent. And Peter Baldwin and co. were only really just taking over from John Thompson, that wonderful description of commercial radio he had as radio in jeans. He described commercial radio. And so Peter Baldwin had started, and he had got a pretty good team around him. Paul Brown, David Vick. I suppose at AIRC, I saw the opportunity to be less adversarial and to sit round the table and adopt a position where we could be the centre of the decision-making process rather than sitting outside it and throwing stones and moaning about the decisions that were made. So my hope is that during my 3 years was to be able to get that relationship right between the producers of radio programmes and the regulator. And a great deal of progress was made. I'm not saying we got everything we want. The radio authority saw their remit was to grow radio. There were some amongst us who believed that if you grew radio, they would lose revenue. I didn't subscribe to that. I thought that there was a lot of revenue out there and we would chase it.
Hi there, it's David Kid Jensen here with the very first Network Chart Show coming at you right across the nation on independent radio. Now, every Sunday afternoon...
And I'm distinctly proud of what we achieved during that period. The Network Chart Show was launched. The first ever sponsorship programme started. Radar started, the first joint research with the BBC. The Radio Advertising Bureau started. The first radio advertising awards started. All of those things happened during those 3 years, which kind of set the foundations for future growth of the industry. And the other thing that happened was that after 10 years, we actually won the copyright dispute with PRS and PPL, who were milking radio stations dry. 7-8% of revenues were going out of the window. When I became chairman, I took over from Bill McDonald, who had been at Radio Hallam, and he'd been banging his head against the wall for 2 years on this. And I met up with Richard Eyre of Capital Radio and Jimmy Gordon, Lord Gordon of Radio Clyde. And we said it's going to end, and we took advice, and we said the way we're going to end this is take them to the Monopolies and Mergers Commission. And we took them. Now, if Jimmy and Richard had gone by themselves, it would have been big, rich guys pleading they can't afford to pay. By taking me in with the support of the small stations, I could do the sackcloth and ashes routine and describe how us paying £5,000 a year when we're losing £5,000 a year and talk about community and the rest of it. And we won. And copyright fees were halved. Two of our QCs, one was Christopher Clark, and the other man was a man called John Swift. And John Swift is also important in my story. So by the late 90s, I found myself in a fairly central position, both industry-wise and operating a medium-sized PLC, and enjoying both enormously, although having its stresses and strains too. The fact is that Mid Anglia Radio were a company that had grown organically. We hadn't gone out and bought lots of radio stations. We actually won all our licenses. We had become involved in some small investments in KCBC in Kettering, in a radio station called WMK, Wicked Neutral and Kicking in North London, that shared a frequency with a Greek radio station. Anyway, we had these bits and pieces as well. And we were really a ripe cherry to be picked. We weren't big enough to challenge GWR, Capital, etc. But we were big enough that we couldn't be ignored. And a takeover bid came in from East Anglian Radio, Russ Stewart, who was based at Radio Broadland. And it's interesting because he immediately became a rival, and yet when you're involved in the first 19 stations, actually you all know each other. All the programme controllers have got each other's telephone numbers, and the managing directors have as well. You can have a meeting in one fairly small room. But Russ launched this bid, and I was incredibly angry about it because he didn't tell me. He did it through his shareholders, and we had shareholding in common: Anglia Television, EMAP, and Eastern Counties Newspapers. And in our case, it made up 43% of our shareholding. Now, it's pretty difficult not to be taken over if the other side starts with 43% of the equity in the bag. But they'd only bid £2 a share. And I said to our chairman, Martin George, that doesn't seem right to me. So Martin George said to me, can we do any better? And I said, I think we can. And I rang up an old mate of mine, whose name was Ralph Bernard. And I said, you're in the acquisition mode. I know it's all down in the West Country, but why don't you have a dabble in East Anglia? And he said, not half, let's have lunch. Took me out for an expensive lunch and said, how much do you want for it? And I didn't say anything. And he gave a number and I pulled a face and he gave me another number, which was double the number that Russ Stewart had offered. So I went back to Martin George and said, this is what we're offered. So he said, well, you need to get 50% of the shareholders to agree with it. And secretly, David Lovell and I, the finance director who went on to run the Tyndall Group of stations in East Anglia, hit the phones, rang all these little shareholders, got onto fax machines to people who were on holiday in Spain, to their estate agent, and we got 50%. And I rang up the company secretary of EMAP and Russ Stewart, who called me all sorts of names under the sun, said we've got 50.5% irrevocables to sell to GWR. And that's what we did. East Anglian Radio had gone about it the wrong way. The way we went about it with GWR is that we had built in some checks and balances for our staff that I wanted. They weren't going to last forever, but they were there. GWR asked me to stay in as their regional director because their plan now was to take on the world and take over East Anglian Radio and Chiltern Radio, which of course they did. And Mid Anglia Radio was the key to unlock that. And the rest of the story everybody knows. It grew and it grew and it grew. But I built this company. I'm not saying it's grandiose to say it was in an image of me, but it was something that I was very close to. And people I cared for had built it. And I didn't want to be part of dismantling it. And so I said I didn't want to do it. And we parted as friends. And I was asked to lead the group to win the second license in Peterborough. And we did, against competition from Kiss FM and others. And we started Light FM, a little radio station. One of the shareholders was Peter Dore, who had invented Pipex and was a multimillionaire and wanted to do some media things. And later, after we sold Light FM, because, again, the owners had different aspirations, the co-op in Peterborough got a different boss. So it was going to become complicated. So we sold Light FM to UKRD. I went with Peter Dore to set up Dore Media, which was a cable channel called Red Television. Eventually Cambridge Community Radio, who Peter had invested in heavily. We bought back KLFM and set up this little media company for Peter Dore, who is an extremely generous man and an extremely wacky individual. So what was the link with a QC representing the radio industry at the Monopolies and Mergers Commission against the might of PRS and PPL? After we'd won the case, we went out to dinner, Richard Eyre, Jimmy Gordon and myself, and John Swift, the QC. And over coffee, he said, do you like railways? And I said, well, I travel on trains, it's all right. I used to go on holiday with my mum and dad down to Worthing, etc. I come up and down to London. He said, oh, it's just that I've got something that might interest you. And I forgot all about it. And 6 months later, I read in the newspaper, John Swift QC had been appointed the first rail regulator of the privatised rail industry. And 3 months after that, I got a call saying, we really need someone who can sort out rail passenger representation because we've got this rather fusty old organisation called the Central Rail Users Consultative Committee, made up largely of men over the age of 65 who spend more time talking about the timetable than about what matters to passengers. So I said yes, and I went in there to modernise this organisation, which I successfully did, using the usual tricks, change the name, give it a bright new logo, get on the radio and in a few magazines, and start talking to people. Again, less adversarial approach. We can tell you what passengers want, etc. And after a year of doing this, in a job that I thought was going to take me away from the public spotlight. Paddington happened, Hatfield happened, Potter's Bar happened, broken rails all over the country happened, and the railway went into the worst crisis since the Second World War.
I'd never heard anything like it, just a huge bang. And then the carriage did what I'd call a pirouette. I couldn't tell what was happening at the time.
And suddenly I was thrown into the public spotlight on every television news bulletin, every news programme. I was Paxmaned, I was Kirsty Young, I was John Humphrey regularly, I was on the sofa with Frost, I was live into 10 o'clock bulletins, and I took the opportunity because suddenly everyone had to listen to the passenger. And all I kept saying was, if you want the solution to this, you've got to listen to the passenger. And we got the passenger a seat at the top table where the decisions were going to be made about franchising, about ordering new trains, about everything everybody knew had to be done. That was a fascinating time. We had two meetings in Downing Street at the height of the crisis with Tony Blair. As I walked out of the corridor from the cabinet room, there was a man standing there, and I didn't know who he was at the time. He was Alistair Campbell, spin doctor for the Labour Party. And as we came out, he stopped us and said, someone's going to have to go out and talk to the press. Nobody fancied it, and he looked at me, and I said, OK, fine, I'll go. And I never imagined the sight that was going to greet me, because someone opened the door of number 10 Downing Street, and I walked out, and there was a microphone in the middle, and there must have been 500 or 600 television cameras and every other camera pointing at me. And I walked out and I did the classic bit of media training. Take 6 questions and walk. Don't take any more. I took the first 6 questions and started to walk. The other people who had been in the meeting, Gerald Corbett from Railtrack, Sir Alistair Morton from the Strategic Rail Authority, etc., had got all these posh cars or waiting for them. Stuart Francis turned and I thought, where do I go? I'd come out, stride out, media training, stand tall, answer the questions, and I ended rather limply walking down the middle of Downing Street and sort of saying hello to a policeman and walking out. So my sort of piece of drama and 5 minutes of fame disappeared as I rather limply wandered off down Downing Street. It was a fascinating time. I'm proud of what we achieved during that time. And it was during that time that the second tragedy happened in my life. Because after 24 years, I'd been divorced. And 2 years later, I had remarried. And 9 months after I'd remarried, my wife, Jackie, died from leukemia. And it was one of those things that I can look back now, and we had one of everything. We had one Christmas, one birthday, one marriage, one summer holiday. We had one of everything. And she was diagnosed with leukemia, and she survived. She had a particularly virulent form, and she survived for 3 months. And that had an extraordinary, devastating effect on me. And personally, I went through a very, very dark period. And I'm not quite sure how I continue to do things like being chairman of the Rail Watchdog. I understand now that I had fantastic people around me who held me up through a period, and a period of extensive counselling and that sort of thing as well. And I went into fundraising mode, and we built a machine where they could detect leukemia earlier at Peterborough City Hospital, and we raised funds for that. But I think it got to a time when I'd simply had enough, and that was the time that I made the decision that I was just going to stop doing stuff and give myself a break for several years, and that's what I did. I was also, for 4 years, the first chair of the Norfolk, Suffolk and Cambridgeshire Strategic Health Authority, which is the bit I'd wanted to do in memory of my stillborn daughter. I wanted to do something in the health service. And I picked just the right time, because the Labour Party had come in. They were determined to shovel money into the NHS to reduce waiting lists and that sort of thing. So it was a very exciting time to be around, managing 31 NHS trusts in a period of great change. But after 4 years, I'd had enough. I was tired. After 8 years at the RPC, Alistair Darling asked me if I would redesign the consumer representation part of the new Transport Act. So I redesigned the RPC again, and it became passenger focus. And I appointed a board, which included Nigel Walmsley, who was the first managing director of Capital Radio. And at that point, I said, I've done enough. And that's the point when I said, I'm going to have a break. And went to live in Thailand with my wife. And we had our daughter. And we built a wonderful villa in a national park with a lake and a swimming pool near a beach. And that was another dream. And although I don't live there now, I can say that I did build the dream house that I always wanted to. But in 2010, we came back. I'd had some health difficulties. We thought it was better that my daughter would have her schooling in England. It was then that I decided that I would have a third career. So having done private sector broadcasting and public sector railway and health, I did charity and voluntary. And I'm now the deputy chairman of Vivacity, which runs all the cultural heritage, sports, gym, museums, libraries in Peterborough, which I enjoy very much. I still run around the football field refereeing sometimes, and I tutor and mentor young referees, and we have the best scheme in the country for doing that in Peterborough. I'm really proud of so many things that I've achieved in what I still think was commercial radio's most exciting and most innovative period. Because it was very, very special. And you could take risks, and it was sparky, and didn't always get it right, but it was exciting. The public life, I think I did contribute some things. But if I'm honest with myself and I ask, when was I truly happy? It was sitting down behind a desk, mid-mornings, playing some great music, thinking about how they were going to segue, what the next speech section was going to be, who I was going to be interviewing. And it was the magic of radio.
On Monday, of course, Peter Milburn.
And I sometimes ask myself, why did I do all that other stuff? I was actually quite good at doing that. I wonder what would have happened if I'd stayed doing that. But all those wonder if questions are pointless, aren't they? I did what I did, but put me in that studio with the cart machines and the turntables and everything else. I'd be happy as a sandman. I am the only one of the first 19 managing directors who did not walk out a millionaire, because all I really cared about was the programming and the people. That doesn't make me an angel. It makes me doing what I want to do. That's where my focus was. So, yeah, I would like to be remembered about making a difference to commercial radio and helping some people along a route to some great careers.